opinion that the provisions of the Bill of Constitution is sound, and they do not infringe on any fundamental rights, and they've been referred into Cabinet. The aims of the bill is to deal with definitions and delete those definitions that became obsolete. It also provides for matters relating to the establishment, amalgamation and dissolution of the SICA. It provides for the incorporation of a subsector of one SICA into another SICA. It also provides for the composition of an accounting authority for each SICA. It regulates the eligibility to become a member of a SICA. It provides for a constitution for every SICA. It regulates the conduct of members of the accounting authority and the members of staff, and it also requires the accounting authorities to disclose any conflict of interest. It repeals certain, and also amends certain provisions which became absolute as a result of the transfer of the administration to the Minister of Education and Training, and those areas which belongs to the authority of the Minister of Labour, and matters connected therewith. So, if we can deal with it on a clause-by-clause approach, so the first clause is dealing with the introduction of a number of definitions that relate to a SICA and the constitutions of a SICA. These clauses are also this clause also provides that certain definitions be corrected or be deleted because they become redundant, and it is more of a technical nature. The next bunch of clauses, they are all dealing with the aspect of those employment services and Productivity South Africa, which, as I've indicated, are falling within the domain of the Minister of Labour. These clauses are 2, 4, 14 to 19, 21 to 26 and 28. And these clauses must also be read in conjunction with clause 30, sub 3 of the bill, which provides that the minister cannot determine a date on which these sections will become enforced, and that means the date when they will effectively be repealed out of the current legislation, unless the minister has the approval of the Minister of Labour before that notice has been or can be published. Clause 3 is dealing with the substitution of a reference, which is a reference to the old SAPRA Act.
Sorry, Madam Chair, I know it's not time for questions, and it's with due respect that I've just asked this question. Because I know of training, I need to get clarity on something here on that clause that we were just with. And I just want to know, it says the Minister of the Department of Labour, but isn't it under the Department of Higher Education with the Minister of Higher Education? I'm confused about this. And I'm just asking this question because it's very relevant to this. If the advocate can just quickly in a short...
Honourable Member, I think advocates will clarify that. That is why we are having this amendment, because some of the responsibilities were under the Department of Labour previously. So that is why we are having this amendment. But I'll allow the advocates to explain further after he has done with the presentation.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think the Honourable Member is referring to the last bullet on this slide. And, moment and to understand.
Advocate, let me just interrupt. I'm going to request you to please and members just note the clarity you're seeking questions so that when you deal with that, then you'll be in a position to respond to all of this.
Okay, fine. I'll then come back to this issue at that stage. Chair, I was dealing with clause 5. Clause 5 is dealing with an amendment to section 9 of the Skills Development Act. Chair, it's a section that deals with the establishment of CETAs, and the amendment is in particular to section 9.1 of the current Act, which provides more clarity on the basis, first of all, that a CETA is established for a specific time frame, which is determined by the minister, and which is the minister's obligation to provide the CETA with a constitution at that stage, and the constitution must be in line with the standard constitution as is provided in section 13 of the Skills Development Act. The next issue, what is important, is amendment to clause 6, which seeks to amend section 9 capital A of the Skills Development Act. This section 9A in the existing act is dealing with amalgamation and the solution of CETAs, but here the consequences, how you deal with the employment issues, how you deal with the assets, have not been addressed, and this bill seeks to clarify and strengthen those provisions. The next clause, clause 7, introduces a new section 9B, which provides for the incorporation of a part of or a section of a CETA into another CETA. Chair, with the CETA landscape that came into effect in 2011, it was one of the difficult aspects when the incorporation of different subsections had to be managed, and there were no legislative guidance. With this approach, it is basically providing a legislative framework by identifying the standard identification codes which is used in the establishment of a CETA, and use those so-called C codes to identify that area of responsibility that will move from the one to the other, and then by way of a notice the minister will transfer the one portion to the other CETA, and also provide with the personnel issues dealing with the assets and all consequential issues relating to that action. Clause 8 is providing an amendment to section 10 capital A of the Act. Section 10 capital A is dealing with a service level agreement which must be entered into between the CETA and the department on an annual basis. What we've tried to deal with in this amendment is to align the service level agreement with the responsibilities of the minister within the government policy to ensure that there's no disjuncture in that regard, and also to ensure that the functions and the performance agreement of the chief executive officer of the CETA is also aligned to the service level agreement, so that one works as a package towards the delivery of their responsibilities within the set timeframe. The next clause, clause 9, is a very important clause. This clause is an amendment to section 11 of the Act, and basically rewrites the section 11 in totality. It provides for a few very important principles. First of all, it provides the size of a
office,
which provides that the council may not be more than 14 members, but six of those members, or not more than six members, must be from organized labor, not more than six members from organized employers, and the remaining two members must be appointed from nominations received from departments, which is not employers, professional bodies in that sector, bargaining councils, or organizations in a community with unidentified interests. Chair, the commission also provides a criteria that the minister must take into account in order to appoint these members, but what is also important is a process which provides that the minister will invite nominations from the different categories or constituencies through the chief executive officer, and that nominations will then be the basis for the appointment of the members. So, Chair, what is important is that it provides a structured framework within, where there's objective criteria and requirements, providing a framework for the minister to exercise his discretion within the ambit of the Act, which will provide a more effective accounting authority to manage the affairs of the SICA, which will be more effective and which will provide a better service delivery to SICA. Chair, this is a very important amendment. Chair, the one aspect that's very important also is that the chairperson will not have voting rights, except a casting vote if there's equality of votes. Chair, the intention is for the chairperson not to align, but to take the best interests of the SICA and manage that in the meeting and deal with the constituency interests without being part of any of the constituencies. So here is a very important principle which has been widely accepted. Furthermore, here it is also providing the identity within or the structures of the constituencies and the definitions of the constituencies has also been improved. First of all, there's always been a very quite a confusion about an employer organization, because in certain sectors you would find state as an employer is a very important constituency, but because the state is not structured with employer organizations in the true sense of the word, it has always been a bone of contention. With the new definition, an employer is clearly defined to be a employer organization, as is provided in the Labor Relations Act. Chair, it also provides for those smaller employer organizations within the sector, which do have an interest in the sector, but do not have the negotiation power, as you would find in the Labor Relations Act. And then, Chair, it also very importantly includes the state as the employer within that sector. So, Chair, it will assist with the understanding of who is the employer. Chair, there is always a bit of confusion because the department do play also a role in a CETAS where they might not be the employer. DEI do play a role in quite a number of the CETAS, although they are not the employer. And therefore, Chair, the two members that be appointed by the minister from nominations of the professional bodies, the bargaining council. there are two slots. So the minister will always be put in a position to deal with it, and therefore the Act provides in Section 11 that the minister must take the composition as a whole when determining and make the appointment of these members. Clause 10 is dealing with two new sections, actually three new sections, sorry, the typing error. The first issue there is a new section 11A, which is dealing with the eligibility criteria for a person to become a member of the accounting authority. And Chair, what is very important is it is making sure that that it is dealing with issues relating to fraud, and a person who has been found guilty of fraud or corruption cannot be eligible to become a member. Chair, it is also important that criminal record involving theft and fraud and forgery is also a disqualification. The new section 11 then also it's 11B prescribes the criteria to vacate an office by members of the accounting authority, and the new section 11C, capital C, requires that members must disclose any conflict of interest. The members may not be appointed unless that disclosure has been made and that he or she has no direct or indirect interest in the CETA. If a conflict of interest occurs at any stage during proceedings, the member who has that conflict must disclose such interest and may not participate in the proceedings. And if the member fails to disclose the interest or is present at the meeting, the proceedings will be null and void. Clause 11 is dealing with the amendment of Section 13 of the Act. Once again, this is a very important amendment. It is dealing with the Constitution. It provides that the minister can determine, first of all, a standard constitution through regulations, and then provide each of the CETAs with their own constitution based on the standard constitution, or the word that the Act uses, that is in line with the standard constitution. It also provides some form of flexibility, and there is the option that the CETA may apply to the minister on the basis of these three criteria. First of all, that there is a unique function or operational requirement that necessitates the deviation. The application must also be justified within the National Skills Development Strategy. And lastly, there must be a recommendation also from the National Skills Authority to allow for such a deviation. The intention of this new Section 13 is to provide a standard constitution which makes the management and also the whole operations of the CETAs more uniform, and which will also assist the department in providing assistance to the CETAs. It also acknowledges that there might be unique situations that you cannot accommodate in a standard constitution, and therefore the flexibility is needed. But it is also important that it is not the unfettered discretion that's given to the minister. It must be within objective criteria and the criteria of the National Skills Development Strategy as a driving authority members and the members of staff, and there's dealing with the conflict of interest issue that was raised in clause 11 capital C, and it provides the type of conduct which is that it cannot be of any conduct that relates to business of a commercial or financial nature. It also provides further that any person that may draw the attention to the chairperson of such a conflict of interest, therefore whistleblowing provision. And in chair, it also requires that the member must recuse him or herself from that meeting. Chair, the new clause 13D provides for the appointment of the chief executive officer. Requires that the CETA must provide three names and with specific criteria. The person must have certain qualities. That person must have experience in accounting, financial, and senior management matters. The minister will appoint the CEO from that list of names, and the term of office of the CEO is linked to that of the accounting authority. It provides a transitional arrangement in the bill. It states that the CETA may extend the contract for 6 months of that CEO in order to appoint a new CEO for the new CETA. Obviously, will mean that the CEO can be reappointed, but it doesn't mean an automatic right to continue with that employment when the new CETA is coming into existence. Clause 13 amends the current section 20 of the Act. There's a technical amendment. Once again, it is to deal with the reference to the South African Qualifications Act, which has been repealed, and the reference is therefore replaced with the MQF Act. Clause 20 is once again the technical amendment relating to the MQF Act. Clause 30 is a technical amendment to the long title, which replaces the reference to the National Qualifications Authority Act with the National Qualifications Framework Act, and then clause 31 is dealing with the transitional arrangements. This transitional arrangement is first of all to say if the minister must want the standard constitution has been published in terms of section 13 in regulations, then the minister must identify if a CETA's constitution is in line with that standard constitution. If not, is it possible to deal with it in terms of the criteria that has been prescribed by section 13 sub 3 to deviate from the standard constitution? If that deviation is possible, then obviously that constitution will then be provided as a constitution to that CETA as a deviation in terms of that provision. But if it is not possible to accommodate the current constitution within the flexibility of section 13 sub 3, then the minister must align and provide the CETA with a new constitution in line with the standard constitution for the deviation. Clause 32 provides for the short title and commencement. And once again, this is a very important clause as it is linked to those clauses that has been identified under the domain of the Minister of Labour, or remain under the domain of the Minister of Labour, and that is part of the Skills Development Act, although the Act is not under the administration of the Minister of Labour, and therefore is a cleaning up of the Act, and it is therefore that those clauses can only come into effect if the Minister of Labour agrees to it. Chair, I know it is related to the Honourable Member's question, and I will deal with it after this presentation in more detail. Thank you, Chair. That is the point.
Thank you for the presentation.
Now, the is a the minister, or is it the accounting authority, or the minister, that is no consistency, and then somebody must override the act and put up an additional clause to deal a tendency that shall have emanated from dispute or whatever. Who determines it?
You have disclosure of conflict of interest, and you say a person may not be appointed on an accounting authority unless the necessary disclosure has been made. And then on 13A, Romantica 2, the topic there, any member of an accounting authority or any member of the staff of the teacher, Romantica 2, may not conduct business directly or indirectly with the sitter, which constitutes a conflict of interest with the sitter. Is it allowed or is not allowed? This woman take a two young data. Thanks.
First of all, the question of the number of cases that need approved by this amendment. The House must remember that the proclamation by the President to assign the statutory responsibility to the different ministers provides, came to the issue of the authority as contained in the Skills Development Act, that the Act as a whole is assigned to the Minister of Higher Education and Training. But there is certain provisions that has not been assigned in that Act that remain with the Minister of Labour, because the function of Productivity South Africa and Employment Services did not move with the functional shift that came about in 2009. Now, these are all those sections as identified in the protocol, which, although it is within the Act, which has been assigned to the Minister of Higher Education, but that specific sections of the Act did not move together with that, and this is to clean it up and to provide the space for the Minister of Labour to actually bring legislation under the control of the Minister of Labour into effect before this statutory provisions are repealed. That repealing of those sections must not create a vacuum, must not provide a situation where there is no legal framework to the Minister of Labour. And therefore, we could not deal with it last year, because at that point in time, there were no legislation in place. This year, legislation have been implemented or have been processed through this Parliament, and it is in the process of coming into force. But there's different time frames also for the legislation to come into effect, and therefore it was necessary to identify that category of sections that needs to be repealed in order to clean up the legislation and to make the Act as a totality under the authority of the Minister of Higher Education and Training. But it is done within a structure where that coordination is required to avoid any vacuums or situation where the statutory framework have been ripped out of the legislation and would determine the activities and functions of the Minister of Labour. The issue of the disclosure of interest, as is provided in the new section 11C appointment of the members to the accounting authority. And Chair, it is providing an important structure that a member who is to be appointed must declare that Chair, if that member fails to appoint, there's also consequences. And that is the whole theme of Section 11. Section 13, which is 13A, which is dealing with the conduct, is dealing with a member and of staff and a member of the accounting authority, where the relationship is already in existence, that new business opportunities come into place, and where there is a requirement that such a member must declare it and not participate in the decision-making process. And the wording of 13A may not have a conflict of interest is a prohibition that not is very clear. Must before the meeting inform the chairperson. If that person failed to do it, the whistleblowing position is also then provided for. And it's also providing a definition of what is this business we are talking about. It cannot be for a direct or indirect financial personal gain that does not form part of this relationship. And it also then provides not only the sanction to it when a member being appointed and did not recuse him or herself or did not declare the issue beforehand as is contemplated in Section 11 situation, but it is also then providing that member, there's a sanction to the member that the member can be suspended from meetings, or that the member that membership can be terminated because it is now dealing with the relationship of the appointment. So the issue there is very clear that it is a prohibition. There's no doubt in our minds, and it was considered by not only the state law advisors and the parliamentary law advisors also agree that this is a total prohibition of any such actions, and the conduct must be declared. The principle is to declare and not to take part in the decision-making process. If a decision is taken where the individual can be affected, is not part and parcel to it, then at least it is an informed decision taken by the county authority and it is not influenced by the fact that that person being part of that meeting. Chair, the issues of the roles and the responsibility of the CETA. Chair, it is important that we are dealing here with an amendment act. And an amendment act obviously is not rewriting everything that's already in the current or the principal act. Chair, the functions of CETA have not been amended, and the functions is dealing with the roles and responsibilities of CETA. The responsibility obviously is a slightly wider concept because the issue of how you are constituted and how you are dealing with the conduct of your members, the conflict of interest provisions is also an aspect of a responsibility. member of the Northern Northwest Province as to the criteria when it comes to the appointment that those issues contained in Clause 10. What is very important is a conviction of those offences by a court of law. So it is not a broad corrupt activity that we are talking about in that aspect, that it must be a formal conviction. And it is to deal with the type of character that is not suitable to be a member. When it comes to the provisions as is contained in the new Section 11C and 13A, that is dealing with corrupt activities and which will be dealt with on its own merits. And as I say, a code of conduct is a part of the standard constitution, and the code of conduct will then deal with any action to be taken by the members. The code of conduct obviously will be part of the regulations. As I indicated, it is the part of is listed as a aspect that must be contained in the standard constitution, as is the per the amendment of section 13 sub 2 of this act, and therefore the detail will be dealt with in that process. But it is not just a wide statement, it must be followed by a proper procedure and the finding which will come to an outcome. But the sanctions of the outcome is provided for the legislation. Chair, then the aspect of the deviation, who will be responsible to take that decision? The act is clear, it can only be the minister, and the minister can take that decision only within the three criteria provided by the act. It is important that when you give discretion to an administrator, the administrator cannot have an unfettered discretion. It must be guided by objective criteria. And the three criteria provided by the Act is dealing with it. Yes, there is flexibility, because the uniqueness of the operational requirement is it is fairly wide in scope. But it is determinable, and it is providing a focus as to what would be this unique operational requirement. If it is a requirement which is common to any of the others, then outside that criterion, that deviation will therefore not be within the prescripts of the Act. So, Chair, the process is very clear, and the structure that's provided is to enforce a uniform approach when it comes to a constitution. It is a uniform approach as to size, as to function, as to the composition and the relationship of the constituencies within it, and to have a medium to small accounting authority to manage the affairs of a CETA, and not to have a public hearing each time there is a meeting by that authority, which actually caused a problem. We've had the example of one CETA being 68 members. It's very difficult to take decisions in that size of a governing structure. So I don't know if my colleague want to add to anything I've addressed, but I think I've covered all the questions.
Honourable members, is there anything? Honourable Father, I think it will be one because we are going to have an opportunity when we deliberate. Honourable Father, and then Honourable Premier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just like to know from Honourable Skirt Bossoff, and this is specifically, isn't there going to be contradiction between the two ministries? The reason why I'm asking this is specifically if you look at this clause 32 at the end, it says the minister, however, after section going to be controversy because the one minister of higher education eventually is, as I see it, perhaps I'm wrong, overseeing the whole process. Those are the Department of Labour's minister are running the whole thing. I just want to know, will there not be any two bosses running the same type of thing, if I can say it that way, on specific functions, or are they clearly defined to say which will be in charge of what? Because as it seems, because it falls under the higher education, definitely that's operational by the Department of Labour. Somehow, in my eye, I see that the Minister of Higher Education is the overseeing body of this whole act, if I can say that, of the bill.
Thanks so much, Chairperson. I also think further carriage. You're saying session is for the current staff or current board members. Is it enough just to say I currently have a business and there's a new project coming in, just to declare a potential possible conflict of interest? Because what used to happen is that a director or a person in charge of a project will be part of the proposer of the project, developing the criteria of qualifying, and then apply. So there's no way, I don't know whether the Roman figure 2 stop that person, or is just to declare and continue the business, whereas the initiator of that project and the end applies and just disclose. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. The role of the two ministers within the current act, and I think one must first deal with the current situation, is to say the President, in terms of Proclamation number 56 of 2009, September 2009, provided that the Act, the Skills Development Act, is going to the Minister of Higher Education, except for, and then it is that list of clauses. So although the Act is under the control of the Minister of Higher Education and Training, those functions have never moved. So the Minister do not have an oversight function on employment services or Productivity South Africa. So these two different ministers dealing with it, but unfortunately, the reality, it was contained in one piece of legislation. And the Act as a whole went over, except for those handful of clauses or other sections. And it is not a good principle to have legislation contained in legislation under the control of the different minister. And therefore, we have to allow for a process in order for the minister to delete those clauses or those sections in order to get the Skills Development Act as a totality under the control of the Minister of Higher Education and Training. And that's what we have to deal with. But here we must coordinate between the two ministers that the other legislation had been developed by the Minister of Labour, that new legislation would be in place before this repeal can take place. And that is why the two ministers must agree. And Chair, there is no doubt in my mind that the Minister of Labour is as eager to get rid of these provisions in the Skills Development Act. But she's also very mindful that there must be a statutory structure to replace them before that happens. So it is a matter of alignment, and one cannot deal with it in any other way because of the different processes, different committees, different time frames that are subjected to the different legislation, that one must deal with it in a way that is provided for this piece of legislation. Chair, the issue of the conflict of interest. Chair, clause 13 everyone knows that that product is manufactured by a company where this professor also got a substantial interest in. So here, the issue there is not to prohibit that type of scenario, but it is to prohibit the one who is taking the decision not to enrich him or herself or his or her immediate family, her spouse or partner, as the words used, when dealing with that decision. And therefore, that person must declare, and it is a prohibition, that that person cannot be part of if there is such a relationship, then that person must declare, must move outside the meeting, and must make sure that he or she do not influence or does not influence that proceedings. So here, if that person decides not to do it, then the whole proceedings will be null and void, and it means the whole process must start afresh. It is also important that the whole concept of interest has been thoroughly debated, not only through this legislation but also the other two pieces of legislation. And the concept of interest is actually a very concept, because it's very wide and it can have a lot of ramifications. But what we've tried to deal with here is to deal with the interest in the decision making and not the interest in the actual development. Because if there is an absolute need for that product, because it is the only product that can be obtained in order to deliver to the needs of that institution, then it must be allowed. But what is important, it must be a decision which is informed by the knowledge that there is such an interest, where the decision is taken within the knowledge of the corruption principle, and where the decision is then justified on the basis of the